This is Grow in Grace, a daily teaching ministry of Palmetto Baptist Church in Greenville, South Carolina. Some of the smallest things make the biggest impact. A massive ship can be directed through the seas with a small rudder. Horses are directed by small bits attached to their bridles. Our tongue is a very small part of our body, but it can have a massive impact for or against God's kingdom. Today, Pastor Sam Horn will continue a sermon from James chapter 3 titled, Master Your Mouth. Let's listen together so we can grow in grace.
Your tongue has the ability to shape your life. It has the ability to shape the mission God has called you to do. It has everything to do with your spiritual maturity. It has everything to do with your spiritual stability. It has the ability to do great good, and it also has the ability to do great damage. So who is controlling your tongue? And you can see in verse 8, where he's going. Look at verse 7. For every kind of beast and bird and reptile and sea creature can be tamed and has been tamed by mankind. Go all the way back to the Garden of Eden. The very first thing that God said to Adam and to Eve was, you are to go and you are to subdue the earth. And James is recognizing that there is not an animal on the earth who has not been subdued. That's the idea of tame. It's not the idea of you taking your dog and teaching your dog a trick. We have two dogs in our house, and there's a certain person in our house who is a dog whisperer. And this person can make those dogs do anything. And then I come along thinking, oh, this is great. And I try to get the dog to do that, and nothing happens. Or nothing good happens. And so the idea, when we think of the word tame, we're thinking about a dog that can do tricks, or a bird that can talk, or a parrot that learns some words. And so the idea is there, we can tame a creature. And that's not the idea behind the word tame here. It's the idea of control and subdue. Human being, mankind, has subdued the earth. Animals do not run this planet. Animals do not control what you do in your life. Animals have been subjugated, and depending on what your view is on the whole, what animals are for, you know, whether you think you should eat them or not, they've been subdued. Even if you don't think you should eat them, you don't think they should rule your life. And that's James's point here. James is saying, look, the entire creation has been subdued by man, but there's one part of creation that has not been subdued, and it's man. It's man. How do you know that man has not submitted himself to God? And James's answer is, look at what comes out of his life. Look at the damage that is done by one human being to another human being. Look at what comes out of his life. And we're going to see that in chapter 4. When we get into chapter 4, James is going to lay out the damage that is coming out of even the life of a believer whose tongue and whose mouth is out of control. And so James's point is this: who is going to subdue the tongue? And the answer is, no man can subdue the tongue, and we're going to find out why. So the only way to subdue the tongue is to subdue the man. And the part of man that has to be subdued for the tongue to be subdued is the heart. Because Jesus said, out of the heart, what? The mouth speaks. So when you look at James chapter 3, it's not just about learning enough self-discipline so that you don't say everything that comes to your mouth the minute it comes to your mouth. I mean, that it needs to start there, right? I mean, we can't just like open our mouth and damage other people with our words. We need to be thoughtful about how we communicate. But if that's all we do with James chapter 3, we've missed the big idea that James is putting out there. James is doing a whole lot more than just telling you, be careful how you use your tongue. Don't use it in cutting ways. Don't be critical. Don't be caustic. Think about the damage that it can do. All of that's true, but James is saying much more than that. He is saying that your life has a mission, and that mission is going to be advanced not just by what comes out of your mouth, but by everything that comes out of your life. And if you're going to control your life, you're going to need someone to control your heart. And the evidence that your heart has been controlled by God is what comes out of your mouth. Okay, does that make sense? That's the flow of the passage. And so with that in mind, I want to come back now and I want to make 3 points this morning from chapter 3. And there's a lot we could say, but let me just lay out 3 big ideas and then make some applications to our life. Based on what James is saying and the big idea that he's driving at, here's the first thing. James wants us to know our communication is the test of spiritual maturity. Our communication is the test of spiritual maturity. He says this, "Not many of you should become teachers, my brothers, for you know that we who teach will be judged with greater strictness." He's setting you up for something that's going to show up later in the chapter. Look at verse 13. He has a question. Where is the wise man? Who is the wise and understanding? So in your mind, you need to draw a line between chapter 3, verse 1 and chapter 3, verse 13. And he's not just talking about someone who stands up like I do to preach and teach God's word. Or in our next hour, we're going to have our equip classes, and they're going to be men and women who are going to stand up and open up God's word, and they're going to communicate different things from God's word to you, right? So yes, those people are included, but the idea here is that the teacher in chapter 3, verse 1, is the wise man in chapter 3, verse 13. And the idea here is this. If you claim to be spiritually mature, if you claim to have an understanding of the Christian life, if you claim to be at a place where other people should listen to you about your faith or about what you think about your faith, James says that there is an acid test of spiritual maturity. There's an acid test of this. When somebody comes along and starts to tell you about the faith and what you should think, or about some aspect of the Christian life and what you should think, there's an acid test that is going to reveal their spiritual maturity. Now let me stop for just a minute and make sure we understand this. Spiritual maturity is not just a function of time. Sometimes we think that because a person has been a Christian for many, many years, they are automatically spiritually mature. And James is about to explode that thinking. He's not talking about a person who, by virtue of the fact that they've been saved for a long, 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 long time, is spiritually mature. It's also not just a function of what you know. We already saw back in chapter 2 that you can have the right beliefs about God, and James is going to say there's somebody else who has all of those same right beliefs, and you are in their category when you are not living those beliefs out in your life. And he's actually going to say even the demons believe what you believe. Remember that in chapter 2? So spiritual maturity is not the product of you being a Christian for a long, long time, and it's not even the product of what you know. Although the longer you've been a Christian and the more you know about the Christian faith should actually grow you spiritually. But James is wanting you to understand that just because you've been a Christian for a long time, even decades, and just because you think you know a lot of doctrine doesn't make you spiritually mature. It doesn't make you wise. So how do you know a wise person? How do you know when a person is wise? And in the last part of the chapter, James is going to say, a wise person is a person whose life is submitted to and governed by and shaped by a wisdom that comes from above. And there is another kind of wisdom. There's a wisdom that comes from below. And James is actually going to be describing in the first part of the chapter a person whose life and its effects are showing you that they are being shaped by the wrong kind of wisdom. James says there's an acid test of spiritual maturity, and it's this: see what comes out of a person's communication. Now, he's using the word tongue here, and we immediately run to our verbal communication, but he's using that because in the first century, very few people knew how to read, and very few people knew how to write. So the primary way of communication was what? It was verbal. But in our day and age, we have a lot of ways to communicate. We communicate verbally. We communicate non-verbally. We communicate with our fingers. We communicate in all kinds of ways. And so when James is talking about the tongue, it would be a grave mistake for us to limit what he has to say just to what comes out of our mouth. He's talking about our communication in general. So here's the first thing I want to ask you. When you look at your communication over a long period of time, what is the flavor of that communication like? What is it marked by? Is it a flavor that smells of grace? Is it, even when you have to say a hard thing? I mean, sometimes we have to say hard things. But when you have to say a hard thing, is it a communication that is flavored by grace? Is it a communication that is flavored by the Spirit? Is it a communication that is marked by the things that we see down in verse 17? Is it pure? Is it peaceable? Is it gentle? Is it open to reason? Is it full of mercy? Do good fruits come out of that communication? Is it impartial? Are there no hidden agendas behind your communication? That's where James is going with this. As you live in the kingdoms of the world, think about how people whose life is shaped by wisdom from below communicate. Think about why they communicate and what their objectives are in their communication. And James says, now when you communicate in those kingdoms, your communication needs to be flavored by a completely different kind of wisdom. Wisdom from above. And the way you communicate is the acid test of your spirituality. You ever heard of the word acid test? You ever wondered where that phrase comes from? I looked that up this week. I was interested in that because I thought about that. I said, there's an acid test. I don't know why that came to mind, but it did. And I thought, you know, somebody came up with the idea of acid test, and I'm going to find out. So I did a little searching, and I found out that the idea of acid test actually came in 1849 in California. Can any of you remember what was going on in 1849 in the state of California? I can't even remember what was going on last year, but can you remember what was going on back in 1849? Everybody knows, right? It was the very famous California gold rush. And everybody uprooted from the East Coast and made their way as quickly as possible to the West Coast because they knew if they could just get to California, there was just gold lying everywhere. And they could just pick it up and they would become unbelievably wealthy. And so they would get there and they would walk around and they would pan for gold in the rivers. Some of them would dig up gold in the mountains. And there were there was something unusual that was laying around on the ground that looked a lot like gold. It was called iron pyrite. You know it as what? Fool's gold. And so if you filled up your little treasure sack with fool's gold and you went down into the big city and you showed up at the assayer's office and you asked him to cash out your gold and you dumped all of that iron pyrite on his table, he would look at you and he would say, there is no worth to this. So before you filled up your bag with iron pyrite, you needed a test to see whether or not what you were about to put in your bag was real gold or fool's gold. And so there were two ways to test it. Gold is soft. It's malleable, right? Or malleable. And so you would pick up a piece of gold or what you thought was a piece of gold. And one way to test it was you could bite it. And if it was soft, your teeth would sort of make an indentation in that gold. But the problem was, if it was iron pyrite, What would happen to your tooth? It would shatter, or it would break, or it would hurt. So you pretty soon, you know, after you missing a couple of teeth, you decide, I got to have a better way to do this. And so you could take nitric acid, and if you dropped fool's gold into nitric acid, it would instantly dissolve. And so these gold miners developed an acid test to see whether what they were putting in their bag was genuine or not. And here's what James is saying. He is saying there is an acid test that you can use to see whether a person is truly mature or not, truly wise or not. And the acid test is look at what happens when they communicate. Look at their communication. Have you ever gotten a letter from somebody? You know, in my life, I've gotten a lot of letters, and some of them are really nice. Hey, Pastor, we love you. It's so nice that you're here at our church. And you save those letters, right? But every once in a while, you get a letter. Often, it's not signed. You know what I've learned to do with not signed letters? Just drop them in the trash. And I would encourage all of you, if you get an anonymous letter, that's what you do with it. Because the person who wrote that letter doesn't have the courage to tell you what he or she really wants to say, and their communication. Here's what I've noticed about anonymous letters. The communication in those letters is 9 times out of 10 marked by the wrong kind of wisdom. Marked by the wrong kind of wisdom. And so here James has said, you want an acid test for a person's maturity. Here it is. The acid test is what they do with their mouth. Why? Here's why. Because if you have learned how to control your mouth, you have learned how to control all of the impulses that are coming out of your heart. So how we communicate becomes the acid test of spiritual maturity. Here's the second big idea. Our communication is the means of great power and is the source of grave danger. Now, James is talking to people who are making certain claims. Claim number one, we are believers. And that's why he talks to them and he says things like this, my brothers. He's acknowledging their claim. So whoever he's writing to is a believer. They are claiming to be spiritual. And that's why in chapter 2, he says, show me your faith with your words or without your words, right? Remember that? He says, show me your faith without your words, and I'm going to show you my faith by my works. So there are people who claim to be believers and who have the appearance of spiritual maturity, but when you get into their life and you get into what's going on around them, all of the things that mark the world, all of the brokenness that marks the world, marks them. And so James says, it is the test of a person's maturity, but it is also the means of great power and the source of grave danger. And so that's what we see in verses 3-6. And we noted in verse 5, the tongue is a small member, yet it boasts of great things. It has great ability to do things. And James says this, now think about this, how great a forest is set ablaze by such a small fire. Our tongue is great power and great strength. And in verse 3, he talks about the bit and the horse. And in verse 4, he talks about the rudder and the ship. And we noted as we were reading the flow of this together that what James is doing here is he's helping us to see that in the case of a horse or in the case of a ship, these larger objects are used for an intended purpose because somebody is controlling them. Somebody is controlling that horse and somebody is controlling a ship. Now, how many of you have had any experience riding horses? Can I see your hands? I mean, how many of you like to ride horses? I grew up in Texas, so I got to ride quite a bit and enjoy riding horses, but I learned something about horses. The only kind of horse that I want to ride is a horse that is broken. Right? Think about that word broken for a minute. In any other context, when you talk about something that is broken, it's something that has lost its what? Its worth or its usefulness. I had this great computer and it broke. Or I had this, you know, wonderful thing in my house and it broke. And so when we use the word broke or brokenness, it generally means that it's depleted of its usefulness. I am flat broke means I have, all of my resources are depleted. That object that I was using is broken. It's not functional. There's something wrong. But when you say a horse is broken, you're actually saying the opposite. You're saying that horse is now what? It's now useful. It's now usable. So James is actually using this illustration because anybody who has had any experience with horses knows that the only kind of horse that you want to be around, the only kind of horse that is going to accomplish the mission that you have for it, whether it's plowing your field or carrying you or pulling your chariot, the only kind of horse that is going to do that is a horse that has been subdued. Now, can I make a point here? The bit is not what subdued the horse. The bit is what controls it. The bit is how you stop it or how you steer it, right? But the bit is not what broke the horse. The bit is only the implement that you use to guide the horse. Somebody broke the horse. Somebody is behind that bit steering the horse. And then he takes another example. He uses a ship. And he puts the ship in the middle of a storm. Notice what he says in verse 4. Look at the ships also. Though they are so large and are driven by strong winds. This sort of takes you back to chapter 1 when he talks about a double-minded man and he says he is driven, he's tossed to and fro in the storms of life. Here is a ship and it is in the middle of a massive storm and it stays true to course. And the reason it stays true to course is because somebody is guiding the ship by means of its rudder. And so here's James's big point. For you to do the mission that God has called you to do, for you to display a living faith in the little kingdom of the world where God has put you for now, for you to have this wholehearted, single-focused, fully trusting faith and have it make a difference in the lives of other people, somebody is going to have to control your mouth. Because when you control your mouth, you can control the direction and the stability of your life. That's where James is going. Our tongue is the source of great strength and of great power. Let me give you an illustration of this. In 1993, there was a man who stood up in a nation and he opened his mouth and he started talking. And by the time he was done talking, the entire world had been thrust into a global conflict that you and I know as World War II.
Thank you, Pastor Sam. We'll continue this sermon next time on Grow in Grace. Today's speaker, Dr. Sam Horn, is the pastor for preaching and vision at Palmetto Baptist Church. PBC meets at 2730 Anderson Road, Greenville, South Carolina. Join us for Sunday morning worship at 9 a.m. or 10:45 a.m. You can find us online at pbcpowdersville.org. If you have any questions about PBC, please email radio@pbcpowdersville.org. Thanks for listening. Join us again next time so together we can grow in grace.